The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Today on Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt, brought to you in partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy and ADF, Alliance Defending Freedom. Joe Biden did it again.
Listen, you got to come see us when you come to New York, VP Biden.
I will.
It's a long way until November. We got more questions.
You got more questions, but I tell you, if you have a problem figuring out whether you're for me or Trump, and you ain't black.
Larry Elder addresses the Democratic Party.
You've been saying it for decades. All Biden did is parrot what he always hears you guys say.
We will examine the effort to mail ballots to all citizens.
1 in 8 of America's voting registrations are significantly flawed or completely inaccurate.
And we'll look at the Democrats' greatest fear.
Donald Trump rebuilt this economy once. He'll rebuild it again. And the Democrats know that.
I'm Hugh Hewitt. Great to be with you. Catch my program each weekday morning live, 6 to 9 a.m. Eastern Time, and on demand 24/7. Learn more at HughHewitt.com, and let me invite you to join us now by video. And follow me on Twitter at Hugh Hewitt, and follow me on YouTube, Hugh Hewitt Channel. And follow this program as well at Town Hall Review. In a normal presidential election year, and this is most certainly not a normal year by any definition, the presidential campaign would be heating up by now. Summer is nearly upon us. We have two candidates locked in, and the conventions are fast approaching. 4 years ago, Republican candidate Donald Trump was speaking to packed stadiums while Democratic frontrunner Hillary Clinton enjoyed endless hours of favorable news coverage. But this time, President Trump is managing an unprecedented pandemic that has put tens of millions on the unemployment line, killed over 100,000 people, and Democratic candidate Joe Biden spends most of his time holed up in a basement. Biden, who has struggled more than usual to put together complex sentences, is benefiting from his public absence. The media clearly loathe Trump, and so Biden receives adoration from reporters. But you can't hide Joe Biden forever. At times, he emerges from his basement. And when he does, he often stumbles. And this week, the stumble hurt him with a voting bloc that most see as solidly Democratic. I discussed the gaffe with Washington Examiner chief political correspondent Byron York. We'll pick up with the key moments of Biden on a New York-based hip-hop show called The Breakfast Club.
Listen, you got to come see us when you come to New York, VP Biden.
I will.
It's a long way until November. We got more questions.
You got more questions. But I tell you, if you have a problem figuring out whether you're for me or Trump, and you ain't black.
It was an extraordinary moment. I don't think it's easily erased, though the media allies of the vice president will try and erase it. What do you think?
Well, there's been a long debate, apart from Joe Biden, about whether the Democratic Party takes black votes for granted. And it is, and this fits into that. And it was an example of Joe Biden doing precisely that. I think it's going to really play out in his choice of a vice president. Remember, the Democratic Party has not nominated a white man for president since John Kerry in 2004. So they're doing it again with Joe Biden, which has increased calls for him to choose a woman or a minority or both to be his vice presidential candidate. And so he was under pressure to do that before this gaffe. And I think he's going to be under a lot more pressure to choose a woman of color here. There's obviously talk of Kamala Harris, Val Demings, Stacey Abrams, perhaps others. So I think that this puts him in a box and makes it difficult to choose a vice presidential candidate.
Now, Byron, I think the obvious choice is Senator Harris, because Val Demings is a congresswoman with very little national profile, even with the impeachment. Stacey Abrams hasn't won a statewide race and has been trying too hard to get selected. And Kamala Harris is a very accomplished candidate and public figure. There is one drawback, and it's the conversation everyone's having, but not on the air. does the vice president actually emerge as the nominee? Does he have the energy and the capacity to do it? He's done nothing except the basement interviews, the basement tapes, to grab an old rock and roll term for so long that when he showed up at the Memorial Day celebration, appropriately garbed and appropriately solemn, but nevertheless not engaging in the media, I think it grew. And if he can't get through a conversation with Charlemagne the God without a major gap, I don't know how he ever gets through a real media season. And this question, you tell me if it's not been in your conversation. Every circle I have is, does he have the ability to make it? And the question comes up again and again and again. Have you heard it discussed off air? Oh,
of course. Of course. And that's an issue, although I will say, as far as this particular "you ain't black" gaffe, Joe Biden was perfectly capable of making a gaffe like this when he was much younger, and there were not questions about his stamina or capacity. So I will say that. But apart from that, if Joe Biden is elected, he'll turn 80 around the time of his first midterms. This has never, ever happened in American politics. And it is something, I mean, we've known it for a long time. The calendar is what it is. But it's something I'm not sure national voters have grappled with. So I think you're right. I think Biden is going to have to show them. And you don't show them by jogging across the stage to the microphone. He's going to have to show them day after day that he is sharp and on it and appears to have the stamina for the world to begin the world's most difficult job at age 78, older than Ronald Reagan was when he left the job after 8 years.
Yeah, now by jogging across the stage, I am always reminded when he does that of the dance class at the retirement home, which we've seen caricatured in 1,000 movies, right, where people are doing the Roomba or whatever for exercise and keeping their mobility going. But it's not the look. The stately Barack Obama would jock up on the stage, but people would say that man is a basketball player. That man is an athlete. And Joe Biden doesn't give off that vibe. So I think he's got to do a lot of events, and he's got to sit down with media. Now, the interesting thing about Charlemagne the God exchange is that having made the gap or having gone long, he was very quick in the response to Charlemagne. I mean, he wasn't meandering. He wasn't lost in time and space. He was very quick. So that was the mitigating factor, because the argument is that he's not quick, that he hadn't lost a step. He's lost a lap. I don't think he can do that, Byron, unless he sits with you and on Fox News and with people who are going to press him hard for a long period of time. And when does he have to start to do that?
I don't think he ever has to sit down for tough interviews. I think he will sit down for friendly interviews. And so I would not, I would not look at him coming on Fox News, because you're exactly right. It would be a tough interview. It would be a respectful, well-prepared interview. And I think he'd much rather have friendly interviews. He doesn't want to be challenged. He wants to be celebrated.
Well, many others on the left were upset with Biden's slip. Some say he simply said what other Democrats have been saying for some time. Here's Salem host Larry Elder.
What Biden said is standard 101 Democratic dogma. If you don't feel a certain way, if you don't believe that race and racism are responsible for everything, if you don't feel that blacks are still being abused by institutional, systemic, structural racism, then you are a sellout. You are an Uncle Tom. That's just Democrat 101.
If you have a problem figuring out whether you're for me or Trump, and you ain't black.
Remember what Harry Reid said?
I don't know how anyone of Hispanic heritage could be a Republican. Okay, so I need to say more.
And that is why you're finding all of these Democrats defending what Joe Biden said. What are they supposed to say? He shouldn't say that if you don't feel a certain kind of way, you're not black, when we've been saying it for years.
I'm a little revved up, okay, because this is a distraction. Vice President Biden spoke to his comments on the Breakfast Club. He apologized. He clarified. He said he shouldn't have been so cavalier. But we need to move on and talk about the issues that was really at stake here.
He shouldn't have been so cavalier. All he is doing is saying the same crap that you guys say all the time. What did Lonnie Guinier, Bill Clinton's first choice for civil rights division on the DOJ? She talked about blacks being authentic and inauthentic and referred to, if I'm not mistaken, Clarence Thomas as being an inauthentic black. Thomas Sowell, inauthentic black. You've been saying it for decades. All Biden did is parrot what he always hears you guys say. One of Biden's top aides is a woman named Simone Sanders. She was a top aide to Bernie Sanders 4 years earlier. And she's always playing the race card, always talking about how blacks are being aggrieved by institutional, systemic, structural racism. You don't think she said to Bernie, to Joe Biden privately, you know, anybody black who hasn't decided whether or not he wants you or Trump, he ain't really black. You don't think Biden hasn't heard that over and over and over again? And so he gets loose, says the same thing, and gets hammered?
The vice president shouldn't have said it. He apologized for it. But I really think the gall and the nerve of President Trump.
I believe that Joe Biden was incorrect in saying the statement, you ain't black.
Oh, for crying out loud. That's Donna Brazile. Donna Brazile is the one who said when she was a campaign chair of Al Gore that the Republican Party has a white boy attitude. And here she is lecturing Joe Biden for saying the same thing. Has Ayanna Pressley apologized for what she said?
Because if you're going to come to this table and for all of you...
Have you demanded that she apologize? No. Did Nancy Pelosi say she had apologized? No. Did Chuck Schumer say she should apologize? No.
That have aspirations of running for office. For whatever lived experience and identity that you represent, if you are not prepared to come to that table and to represent that voice, don't come. Because we don't need any more brown faces that don't want to be a brown voice. We don't need black faces that don't want to be a black voice.
Joe Biden saying that if you haven't decided as a black person whether or not you want me or you want Trump, then you ain't really black. He has since said that he regrets it, that he was being a wise guy, and he shouldn't have been a wise guy. The problem is all he's doing is reiterating standard Democratic dogma 101. If you don't believe, for example, that all the problems that the black community faces can be directly traced to slavery and to Jim Crow, you're a sellout. You don't believe that what's going on right now is continuation of what Eric Holder referred to as pernicious racism, then you're a sellout. You don't pull that lever for the Democratic Party, you are a sellout. They've been saying it over and over again. As I said, Obama got crushed by Bobby Rush when he ran for the House in 2000. Local writers said that Obama was characterized as not being black enough, not being truly black. Michael Steele runs for Senate. Is publicly called an Uncle Tom by the white president of the Maryland Senate. Are you kidding me? He apologized, but the other Democrats who said right on didn't apologize. Ayanna Pressley at the Netroots conference. We don't need any more black faces who don't want to be a black voice. We don't need any more brown faces who don't want to be a brown voice. How is that any different than what Joe Biden said?
Coming up.
Donald Trump rebuilt this economy once. He'll rebuild it again. And the Democrats know that.
The Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt returns in a moment. This COVID-19 crisis has been straining the limits of our constitutional system. Over the next few years, we'll see a generation of new and grounded policy leaders emerge. They'll be prepared at Pepperdine's Graduate School of Public Policy. Learn more about the deadline for application at publicpolicy.pepperdine.edu. Welcome back to the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt, brought to you in partnership with ADF, Alliance Defending Freedom. At first glance, it seems like a perfectly fine idea to send every registered voter in America a ballot and allow them to vote without risking infection from COVID-19. But there are many reasons we don't do that already. And Democrats who completely control California are well aware of why Democrats want to do it. Dennis Prager discussed the issue with Eric Eggers, research director at the Government Accountability Institute.
I want your assessment of Gavin Newsom in the most populous state in the union saying all ballots, and tell me if I'm right, if that's what he has said, all ballots for this coming presidential election will be by mail. Is that what he has said?
Yeah, he said he's going to mail everyone that's registered to vote, whether they're a legal voter or not. That's an entirely, you know, separate category. But he's going to mail everyone a ballot. And so, you know, that means that everyone in the name of safety will have the opportunity to cast the mail-in ballot. Now, he did in special elections that were held last month for a congressional race in Los Angeles, they opened up new polling places where you could still vote in person and even drop off the ballots. So I think it remains to be seen whether or not people will have the opportunity to cast in-person ballots. I would bet that they will, only because, you know, quite honestly, that people still want to be able to have somewhere to take a ballot. And some people, many people don't trust, as you pointed out, the veracity and validity of mail-in balloting. But in the name of access, Governor Gavin Newsom is mailing everyone that's registered to vote in California a ballot. Yet somehow, in the name of health, they have not banned, which I think is like the largest threat to American democracy that I've ever come across, this practice of ballot harvesting. So I love the idea of protecting America's health. I think I'm worried about the threat to our democracy's health that practices like what Gavin Newsom's doing in California will pose.
What exactly constitutes the threat?
Yeah, it's a great question. So many people in many states, and I don't know how you prefer to vote, Dennis, but I have many friends that prefer to vote by mail. The difference between what they're wanting to do in California and, oh, by the way, what the House Democrats have attempted to do repeatedly to make national law in every single one of their coronavirus response bills is to proactively mail everyone a ballot. And here's why that's a problem. Because when you mail everyone a ballot, that means that everyone that's registered to vote will be receiving a ballot. And as the Supreme Court has pointed out, 1 in 8 of America's voting registrations are significantly flawed or completely inaccurate. That's 24 million inaccurate names, people, potentially people, on these voter rolls that would receive a ballot. So in California, maybe won't make that much of a difference. I don't think there's much of a threat of that state swinging the presidential election this cycle.
So where did you get the figure of 1 in 8 people getting these ballots? Is there something corrupted about it? I don't mean morally corrupted, just legally corrupted. What does that mean?
You know, Dennis, one of my favorite things about doing your radio show is you always fact check me and you're always asking for the bibliography. So that stat came from the Pew Center study, and it was actually cited in a Supreme Court decision in which they upheld the state of Ohio's decision and ability to make sure that their voter rolls were accurate. Because what happens is people, you know, you register to vote, but then people move or they die. The city of Detroit, a lawsuit last year pointed out, had more than 2,500 dead people on its rolls. So you've got voter rolls. You've seen these stats where some counties, I think there's like 350 counties in the country that have more registered voters than citizens of legal voting age. So you've got voter roll bloat as a problem. And so the state of Ohio said, hey, we want to be proactive about this. We want to start making sure that people are actually still registered to vote. They should be voting. And so, of course, that was challenged by many left-funded groups. Supreme Court upheld its ability to do so. And in that ruling, they cited that statistic from the Pew Center.
Politico broke a story this week pointing out what many already know. Democrats would benefit from a disastrous economy in their effort to defeat Donald Trump. And many Democrats are hoping this pandemic gives them the November numbers they need, the awful number they need. But the story began with a quote from Obama economic advisor Jason Furman, who told a bipartisan group, "We are about to see the best economic data we've seen in the history of this country." Even through the Zoom app, he could see shock on the faces of many. Hogan Gidley, the White House deputy press secretary, joined Salem host Sebastian Gorka for a look at the economy ahead.
The Democrat Party are petrified of an economic recovery. Isn't there something wrong with that sentence, Hogan Gidley, that one of the two parties in America is afraid that we will have a strong recovery?
Isn't that, I heard that this morning, Seb, and I thought, are you kidding me? You ought to be very excited about the potential to get people back to work, to reinvigorate this economy. Listen, Donald Trump rebuilt this economy once. He'll rebuild it again. And the Democrats know that. Their entire structure of policy for the last 8 years under Barack Obama and Joe Biden have crippled this economy, have hurt our manufacturing base. Small businesses hurt, big businesses hurt, everything moving along at an anemic pace. This president changed the entire thing. And so now the American people got to see, you changed the policies to pro-growth, to deregulation, lower taxes, and all of a sudden people are being employed at record numbers. They know this is going to happen again, and it's terrifying to them, and that's sad. Because everything about everything to them, as you know, is all about politics. Yes. That's all they care about.
No, it is. It is. It is sad. And the fact is, we're not talking about conspiracy theories. If you look at the map of the United States, if you look at the individual states, it's clear that there is a trend. Those states where Republicans hold the majority, or where the governor is a Republican, they're getting back to business. And it seems to be that if you're in a Democrat state, they're putting the brakes on. Shouldn't there be certain things, Hogan, that are beyond politics? And when we have 34, 35, 36 million Americans added to the unemployment rolls, that should not be a political question.
Well, you'd think people's livelihoods would cut across political lines. I don't want to impugn the motives of a lot of these blue state governors, but you have to begin to ask questions when a lot of the country is seeing downward trends in coronavirus deaths, in coronavirus infection rates, and they're beginning to open. Why aren't all of these other states doing the same? You have to do it in a safe way. You have to do it responsibly. No one's saying to go out there just like it was before. You want to socially distance. You want to wear your masks. But the fact is, this country is seeing, overwhelming desire to begin to reopen and get back out there and get back to work and get back to our lives. And I have to tell you, Secretary Alex Azar of the Health and Human Services had an incredible op-ed in the Washington Post last week, kind of outlining exactly what's going on. The estimates suggest 1 percentage point increases to the unemployment rate translates to a 1% increase in suicide deaths,
yeah,
and 3% increases in opioid deaths. It's not about health versus the economy, as he puts it. It's about health versus health. There's mental health aspects to this. There's all types of screenings people aren't doing now because they're concerned about getting coronavirus from their hospital or from their doctor. And so a lot of people are now coming to the conclusion that the deaths because of the shutdown may, in fact, far outweigh the deaths because of the virus. And so we need to look at how we begin to change that cycle.
Coming up, the lockdown.
This has been economically painful so far. We are at the point where it's about to become economically catastrophic, and we need to stop it before that happens.
The Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt continues in a moment. Hey, thanks for listening to the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt. Our podcast is sponsored by Alliance Defending Freedom. ADF provides help at no cost to those whose liberty is being violated, but they can't do it without your help. Call 800-691-8969. That's 800-691-8969. Or visit townhallreview.com. Welcome back to the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt, brought to you in partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. I'm Hugh Hewitt. Thank you for listening. In the last segment, we examined the possibility of a relatively quick economic recovery as states begin to open up, and some of them quickly. But some states and many big cities continue to stay in lockdown mode. And with each new day, more businesses collapse as a result. David Marcus, writer for The Federalist, joined Kevin McCullough on AM 970 The Answer in New York City. McCullough has witnessed the heavy hand of a lockdown governor in Andrew Cuomo.
You know, he was on with his brother on CNN last week, and they were having that yuck it up about, you know, the size of Cuomo's nose, and there was all this like frivolity, and he's got a grin on his face when he's saying this stuff. This is really rather remarkable that a governor who is overseeing what is nothing but an abject disaster in terms of his handling of the greatest pandemic to hit his state continues to have kind of this lighthearted approach to his day-to-day activities. Here to discuss is a man who had the front page article on the 20th of this month in the New York Post, and the headline said it all. It needs to end now. One man's plea. The Big Apple is dying. The streets are empty. Tens of thousands have been plunged into poverty. and our leaders have no plans and no answers. David Marcus rejoins us. You may be familiar. He has been someone that I have recommended to you in the past. His writings at The Federalist as their New York correspondent officially. David, congrats on the cover of the 20th New York Post, but I wish it were under different circumstances, to be candid, because when you describe 3,500 New Yorkers lined up at a Catholic church to get free food because they won't have anywhere else to get it that day, and that's how they're going to eat, that's just heartbreaking.
It really is. I saw it again today, something that I've never seen. I live down in Bay Ridge, and I was walking over to the grocery store, and on Fifth Avenue, there was a line that literally went around an entire avenue block of people lined up for free food that was being offered at a community center there. I've lived in New York City for two decades, and I've never seen anything like this. We've reached, as I've said all week, this has been economically painful so far. We are at the point where it's about to become economically catastrophic, and we need to stop it before that happens.
What? So let me ask you, because we've been doing a fair amount of speculation, and certainly have had a lot of people on that reflect that tone and tenor. Do you believe that de Blasio and Cuomo are negligent, fearful, or corrupt? Where does the wrongdoing fully fall into most for you?
I think they're scared. I think that they're scared of making a mistake, in particular because with regard to Cuomo, it's clear that he did make a really important and deadly mistake early on with regard to the nursing home. So
right.
I think they feel like their safest move is to do nothing and just stay in the lockdown and make sure that these coronavirus numbers stay low. Of course, the problem along with people going hungry is that people aren't getting cancer screenings. People aren't getting routine medical care. So there's a human toll. There's a life toll that the lockdown takes as well. And they just seem oblivious. I mean, when I watch Cuomo, he acts as if the problem is that, you know, we're all bored and oh, your family's getting on your nerves and there's nothing to watch on Netflix. That's not it. This is an absolute disaster, and he really doesn't seem to.
Well, that's a disconnect.
That.
Yeah, that's a disconnect because that's what he does in his house. He's bored and watches Netflix. The rest of us are trying to figure out if we can plant tomato plants in our backyard because we may not be able to go buy them this summer.
Yeah.
And the disconnect is pretty enormous on that level. The other thing here, too, David, is that the numbers have all been wrong. Everything that we were told was going to be the case ended up being far from it. In fact, we're not anywhere near, even though we have the most number of cases tested positive. And of course, our antibody testing is just getting started. But of all those, we're number nine on the list when it comes to deaths per million in terms of overall. And if you take out some of the mishandling of the elderly, which Georgie Borman, your compatriot at The Federalist, she said something over Twitter on the weekend. I thought it was so good. What we should have done was go all in on the protection of the elderly and kept everything else open.
Yeah, for sure. And listen, I am absolutely sympathetic when it comes to the Trump administration, when it comes to Cuomo and de Blasio, to everybody else, to the fact that this is not only unprecedented, but we were already behind the eight ball because of the lies that, you know, the
China
Communist
told.
Party
yeah.
in China was telling. So this was, we were never going to be able to react effectively to this. But you're absolutely right. I mean, and the other thing that slowly started to happen, and I think that you're seeing now, is what we were told was this scientific consensus on lockdowns never was.
Coming up. Why men should not compete against women.
The fastest sprinter in the world is this remarkable woman, Allison Felix. And literally almost 300 high school boys today can beat her.
The Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt returns in a moment. This COVID-19 crisis has been straining the limits of our constitutional system. Over the next few years, we'll see a generation of new and grounded policy leaders emerge. They'll be prepared at Pepperdine's Graduate School of Public Policy. Learn more about the deadline for application at publicpolicy.pepperdine.edu. Welcome back to the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt, brought to you in partnership with ADF, Alliance Defending Freedom. One of the key cases ADF is battling that we follow regularly is that of women forced to compete against boys. The Alliance Defending Freedom is representing Connecticut track stars forced to watch their dreams crushed by boys who compete as girls. Investigative journalist Abigail Shire is following the case. She recently sat in with Post Dennis Prager.
Tell us what's happening in Connecticut.
Sure. So there are three high school girls now suing their athletic association in Connecticut. And the reason they are is these young women are exceptional runners. They are the very best runners in the state of Connecticut, a state which has a proud history of really great track and field talent and competition. And these young women are suing because for the last few years, they have consistently lost to biological boys who identify as girls, they claim to be girls, and they are allowed to compete as girls. And what has happened is in the last, since 2017, 13 out of 14 state championship events have been won by boys, biological boys now. These are the girls' events have been won by boys. And the boys are now they're also setting records. So they're taking records from biological girls, they're setting them, and they're setting records that no girl can meet. So this is really devastating. It means that now every year in Connecticut, there will be fewer biological girls moving on to regional championships because they are consistently getting knocked out of the top spots.
If this were visited by someone in the past, if what you just said were heard, but even 20 years ago, not 100, they would have said it was science fiction of the most absurd variety.
That's exactly right. It is unbelievable. It's one of those things you can't believe. You have to go into court and argue that this is not fair to girls when every woman knows that, you know, biologically speaking, the advantages in sprinting and in heavy lifting are so vast that men have. That's why they have always separated them. Men have larger lungs on average. They have larger bones. They have more bone density. They have more fast twitch muscle fiber. They have larger hearts. I mean, there's absolutely massive advantages, so massive, in fact, that the fastest sprinter in the world is this remarkable woman, Allison Felix, and literally almost 300 high school boys today can beat her in America. Just in America, 300 high school boys have beaten her record. That's how much faster men are on average.
One of the biggest questions I have about America is this infection of the conscience, as I would call it, and of the ability to reason. How deep is it? In other words, if we took a vote among Connecticut parents, how do you think the vote would go?
You know, it's interesting. I don't know. I think that of all the transgender sort of issues that have been posed in the last, you know, decade or so, this is the one that is most inherently upsetting to parents because they know. I mean, I get calls from fathers who say, this isn't right. My daughter trained so hard. She's up every morning. She's the best runner in the state, and they won't let, and she can't even get the chance to win. I think in general, parents are very understanding and sympathetic. I think feminists have been terrible on this issue, by and large. But, you know, they really prefer the new group that has a claim, and that new group is the transgender group, unfortunately, because it doesn't give girls a fair shot.
Are the parents, families, and the girls themselves in the lawsuit getting hate?
I think they are. I mean, I've talked to some of them, and they do get a fair amount of hate. What they also get is, you know, quiet, you know, people coming up to them just saying quietly, don't tell anyone, but I'm on your side. They get a lot of that.
All right. So the parents or the girls themselves, they have brought to a Connecticut court the case, hey, wait a minute, there's supposed to be equality in sports, and as a female, I am now being forced to compete against males, whatever they may identify as being a separate issue. We keep losing races. 13 out of 14 championships have been won by male bodies identifying as female. Do I have it correct?
Yes.
Okay.
In Connecticut.
What is this judge like?
So the judge just gave a very bizarre instruction in the case. He told the plaintiffs, the young girls, that they have to refer to, and their attorneys, they have to refer to the biological boy competitors as transgender girls. They could no longer refer to them as males in the pleadings. This is a very strange ruling because, of course, at issue in the case is who these, you know, what are the rights and privileges that, inhere in being a girl or a woman. And one of those rights at issue in the case is being called and recognized as a girl. And since that's an issue of a case, the issue of the case really is who is a girl and who gets to be called a girl for the purposes of sports. So for the judge to go ahead and say, actually, we've already decided that before the evidence is brought, we know that these transgender biological boys, that we know that they are some type of girl. So you're now to refer to them as transgender girls. That's highly prejudicial. And he really, really should recuse himself at this point.
What have they been referred to until now?
In the complaint, they were referred to as males. They needed to because, of course, in order to explain what they had, what these girls, why they were complaining, they had to explain, look, however, forget about how they, you know, identify for a moment. The reason we're complaining is because they have male bodies. That's the issue in sports. The issue really isn't, you know, you can be as courteous as you want to a transgender person, and one should, you know, one would think, you know, extend them courtesy in all kinds of situations in daily life. But here is a court case in which the very issue is the maleness of these biological boys. So to tell them they couldn't bring that up in their complaint really hamstrings the plaintiff, and it really shows you where we are in a lot of society, where you won't, where people are so silenced we can't get to the things at issue, and that's impossible in a court of law.
Who is funding the lawyers for the girls?
It's the ADF. So this
okay,
is,
yeah, I want. I didn't know that, but I want people to know that. Because ADF is something I promote a lot, and people should donate to ADF, Alliance Defending Freedom.
Yes,
they do this for free. Otherwise, nobody could afford lawyers here. The state has unlimited funds, correct?
Well, I believe the boys are and the defendants, I think, are represented by the ACLU, which is terrible track record on this
right.
issue. The ACLU cannot wait to give away all of women's rights and safe spaces for some reason.
For the rest of that discussion, go to townhallreview.com. Coming up, the awful death, indeed the murder, of George Floyd.
I don't know how there's any defending this at all.
The final segment of Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt in a moment. If you enjoy the Town Hall Review and you are a person of faith, let me introduce you to another podcast I think you'll like. It's the Christian Outlook. And in it, you'll hear the leading voices in the Christian world engaging the issue of the day. This week, the economic toll of the shutdown has been tough. Josh McDowell looks at the emotional and psychological toll.
If these three were epidemics before the lockdown, think of what they're going to be after the lockdown.
Businesses, churches, and other nonprofits are getting ready to resume activity, but it won't be business as usual. The challenge for leadership.
Leadership in times of crisis, that's when leadership matters.
The shelter-at-home orders are running their course. In short, it's because we have succeeded.
The data no longer suggests hospital overcrowding and health system overwhelming is a problem.
And hear from Albert Mohler on the tension between church and state in a pandemic.
The Constitution of the United States has not been put on pause.
We've got all this and more. To subscribe, go to ChristianOutlook.com. That's ChristianOutlook.com. Welcome back to the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt. In Minneapolis, Minnesota, on Monday night this past week, a policeman used his knee to pin down George Floyd on a busy street for 10 minutes. Several onlookers pleaded for the police to stop as Floyd, an African-American man, struggled to breathe and cried for help. But the officer held him there for that long of a time, and Floyd died. It was a horrific sight, one caught on a video that has since gone viral and led to protests and riots in Minneapolis. Mike Gallagher reacts to the scene.
What certainly is a big deal is the presence of all kinds of protests of a man named George Floyd. It is a horrific, horrific incident that was captured on video as this guy who was apparently being arrested for forging a check. And all you see is this guy on the ground, handcuffed, with the Minneapolis police officer's knee in the back of the guy's neck. He is begging for his life. He said, he kept saying, "I cannot breathe. I cannot breathe. Please don't kill me." And he died. He was killed, evidently. The autopsy results haven't been released yet. It's got, of course, it's reminiscent of Eric Garner, but unlike the Eric Garner case in New York, Garner was pretty aggressively fighting back with these officers in New York, which is why the officers were exonerated. This guy, I don't see any video evidence, at least, of any kind of resisting. He's on his stomach with his hands, you know, behind his back handcuffed. The officer had his knee dug into the man's neck for what was described as between 8 and 10 minutes. I'll be very honest with you. This is a painful thing for somebody like me to say because I respect law enforcement like you can't believe. But I don't know how there's any defending this at all. And in fact, I don't know that there will be any peace or any sense of justice for this man, George Floyd, until there is some degree of criminality in play. And I cannot believe that there won't be criminal charges of some level filed against this officer who, it is believed, essentially killed this guy on the ground. Of course, the police officers were immediately fired. Some people thought that was excessive because, of course, there was no benefit of a hearing or any benefit of any due process. Evidently, the commanders and the law enforcement hierarchy in Minneapolis took one look at that video and said, we're not going to put up with that. So all four police officers involved in the arrest of George Floyd have been immediately terminated. But that certainly won't be enough for the family or the community that is expecting an arrest.
Thank you for joining us for the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt. Catch up on earlier episodes at our website, townhallreview.com, and sign up for a daily dose of the best in talk radio. Special thanks to executive producer Russell Shubin, producer Charlie Richard, David Posey, and Michael Cook, Adam Ramsey, Ben Brigman, and of course, Dwayne Patterson. Let me say thanks once again to our sponsor, the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy and ADF, Alliance Defending Freedom. I'm Hugh Hewitt. Thank you for joining us.